Thank you, Mr. Patchinger. Well, he was in rare form today, wasn't he? I'll tell you. I leaned over just as we were beginning that last hymn to Mrs. Patchinger, and I said, "Don't worry, I think you're okay. You're only related by marriage." And about the camp thing, the oldest staff member we ever had at Heritage in our time there, my wife and I were just quickly comparing notes, was 75. Oldest staff member, 75. So, hey, I don't want to hear any complaints now. Well, it is hard to believe that we have gone from spring back to winter again. We had a text from one of our members in the Meadville Church this morning saying they expect 8 inches of snow tonight in Erie, Pennsylvania. So we could have it worse. The last three Sabbaths have seen what has been, in my time in the ministry, nearly 43 years now, from my frame of reference, a unique series of events. And that is that there has been a death in the areas I serve on each of the last three Sabbaths. March 19th and March 26th in Meadville area, and this morning, April the 2nd, in Cleveland area, with Dick Hendenlang's death about 7 this morning. Two of the three were members of these two Kagwa congregations, one each in Meadville and Cleveland. One was a former member of the Worldwide Church of God who contacted me about 6 months ago and asked to begin receiving visits on a regular basis. I was happy to do that. I first met this gentleman somewhere between 45 and 50 years ago when I lived in Kansas City as a teenager. He was a little older than I by about 11 years, so he would have been in his mid-20s at that time. Became reacquainted in Pasadena when I went to college in Ambassador in 1969. And then more reacquainted about 6 months ago when I began to visit him on a regular basis. He had asked that I conduct his funeral. 3 weeks and three funerals. Mr. Hendon Langs will be later this week, as you know from the announcements. As one of you in the Cleveland congregation here responded to my email this morning about Mr. Hendon Lang's death, the response said, "On the Sabbath, he is at rest." How fitting. Yes, it is fitting. And put together, it has a way of tightening the focus on your outlook on life and on God's plan. Even though I first began to learn about that plan as a boy of 8 years of age. It has a way of helping you look carefully at what's really important in your life. It reminded me of something I used to hear from a white-haired gentleman who used to speak to us fairly frequently. He had been in the ministry quite a while by the time I heard him preach, and he used to say, "It's like being a photographer. It's all in where you put the camera. It's all in your point of view." And he was right. Some call it by different names. Some say point of view. Some say where you're coming from. Others say frame of reference. And as we get closer and closer to the Passover and the days of unleavened bread, we need to be thinking about that whole idea. Where do you put the camera? Where are we coming from? What is our frame of reference? It's worth thinking about and thinking about deeply, especially at this time of year. I'd like to get into it today by way of four examples from God's Word. Please, as we go through these, keep thinking that phrase, frame of reference. Frame of reference. Frame of reference. And then, if you would, turn to Genesis chapter 37. Genesis 37 is the story of Joseph as a young man. Just a teenage boy, apparently. And he had these dreams. about his brothers, in effect, bowing down to him. His brothers obviously didn't react quite the way he had hoped they would. And we go through the story to a point where his father sent him to try to find out what had happened to the brothers who were feeding their flock, and he'd lost touch with them. So as we come down through chapter 37, picking it up just toward the end of verse 17, so just the last half of verse 17, it says, "So Joseph went after his brothers and found them in Dothan. Now when they saw him afar off, even before he came near them, they conspired against him to kill him. Then they said to one another, 'Look, this dreamer is coming. Come therefore, let us now kill him and cast him into some pit, and we shall say some wild beast has devoured him. We shall see what will become of his dreams.'" Apparently the phrase for dreamer in Hebrew could also be translated master of dreams. It was a very mocking term they were using. "This master of dreams is approaching. Let's see what he makes of all this now." But Reuben heard it, and he delivered him out of their hands, and he said, "Let's not kill him." And Reuben said, "Shed no blood, but cast him into this pit which is in the wilderness, and don't lay a hand on him, that he might deliver him out of their hands and bring him back to his father." So that's what was in Reuben's mind. He was saying, "Well, just put him in the pit." I'm sure he sold them on the idea that he'll die soon enough out here if he can't get out of that pit. You just throw him in there and then we don't have blood on our hands. In his mind, he was thinking, "I'm going to come back and rescue him and get him back to our father." So it came to pass, when Joseph had come to his brothers, that they stripped Joseph of his tunic, the tunic of many colors that was on him. And then they took him and cast him into a pit. And the pit was empty. There was no water in it. Now, I suppose that was a good thing in terms of he wasn't sinking in the mud, but it was a bad thing in terms of he had nothing to drink. Stop right there for just a moment. What was going through the mind of Joseph at this point? All you can see is the sky from the bottom of a pit. You can hear the voices of your brothers, perhaps still arguing exactly about what should be done about you and with you. What are they arguing about? You can't quite make it out. You can't quite hear. Will they leave you in there to die? Will they just kill you themselves? I suspect all of those thoughts were running through his mind. Keep that in mind and turn to the book of Job. Job chapter 1. Verse 13. "Now there was a day when his sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house. And a messenger came to Job and said, 'The oxen were plowing and the donkeys feeding beside them, when the Sabaeans raided them and took them away. Indeed, they've killed the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you.' And while he was still speaking, another came and said, 'The fire of God fell from heaven, burned up the sheep and the servants, and consumed them, and I alone have escaped to tell you.' And while he was still speaking, another came and said, 'The Chaldeans formed three bands, raided the camels, and took them away. Yes, and they killed the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you.' And while he was still speaking, another came and said," and I still remember from reading the old Bible story years and years ago by Basil Wolverton, I still remember the way he described this, that it was as if he was seeing it through Job's eyes, that Job looks up to see another servant talking and gesticulating and all excited, and then it said something to the effect that a cold shudder ran through Job, or a cold thought ran through his mind, that the only thing else that he could understand or think the message might be about was his 10 children. And sure enough, "Your sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house. And suddenly a great wind came from across the wilderness and struck the four corners of the house, and it fell on the young men, and they are all dead. And I alone have escaped to tell you. Then Job arose and tore his robe and shaved his head, and he fell to the ground and worshiped. Drop down to chapter 2 and verse 7. Then Satan went out from the presence of the Eternal and struck Job with painful boils from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. And he took for himself a potsherd with which to scrape himself while he sat in the midst of the ashes. Stop here for a moment. What was Job thinking about? Sitting on a pile of ashes, because probably they were soft enough to cushion a little bit the terrible pain from head to foot boils. If you've ever even had one boil, you know what the pain level is. I can't imagine head to foot. He's probably sitting there wondering, why is all this happening? Is God angry with me? Is he punishing me? If so, for what? I don't know for what. How can I ask him for justice since I've not cursed him? I've not accused him of wrongdoing? Wouldn't death be preferable to this? I wonder if some of those thoughts went through Job's mind. Turn back a few pages to the book of Esther. Esther chapter 2. We'll jump into the middle of the story a little bit. Esther 2 and verse 7. And Mordecai had brought up Hadassah, that is Esther, his uncle's daughter, for she had neither father nor mother, so she had been orphaned, and her cousin took her in. The young woman was lovely and beautiful. When her father and mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. So though they were cousins, he presumably was older, perhaps a generation older, or nearly so. So it was, when the king's command and decree were heard, and I'll let you read the backstory in chapter 1 and the first part of chapter 2 about why King Ahasuerus, or we think it was probably Xerxes, was looking for a new bride. So it was, when the king's command and decree were heard, and when many young women were gathered at Shushan, the citadel, under the custody of Haggai, that Esther also was taken to the king's palace, into the care of Haggai, the custodian of the women. Now the young woman pleased him, and she obtained his favor, so he readily gave beauty preparations to her. That is, this individual who was over the house of the women, as it's called in this verse. Besides her allowance, then 7 choice maidservants were provided for her from the king's palace, and he moved her and her maidservants to the best place in the house of the women. Basically, you can say that's a harem, isn't it? Essentially. Verse 11, and every day Mordecai paced in front of the court of the women's quarters to learn of Esther's welfare and what was happening to her. Stop right here. Put yourself in Esther's shoes. Why am I here? Why did the king's agents or soldiers or whatever they were take me to the house of women? Like I said, read harem. Even if I am in the best place in the house of women, what good is that? Why can't I have one loving husband? Why am I surrounded by rivals for the king's affection? He views all of us, mostly essentially, as objects. Why have I been taken from my home with my cousin Mordecai, who cared for me and treated me as if he were my own father? Why? Why am I here? Where is God? Fourth example, Gospel of John, chapter 9. John 9, verse 1. Now as Jesus passed by, he saw a man who was blind from birth. And his disciples asked him, saying, Rabbi, who sinned? This man or his parents, that he was born blind? Stop here. Put yourself in the blind man's shoes. If even Jesus Christ's disciples ask him that question, what must public opinion have already concluded about this man? So what was on his mind? Why does no one have a kind word for me? How long will my family continue to support me with what little I can contribute from my begging? What happens if they disown me? How will I live then? Was I born in sin? That's what I hear people saying. Whose? Mine? My parents? My grandparents? The leaders in the synagogue teach us about to the third and fourth generation. How far back does it go? Am I nothing but the result of somebody's sin? Is this a just punishment? Why am I here? Are all the awful things I hear spoken about me true? Four stories, centuries apart. No apparent connection of one to the other, except for one simple common thread weaving through each life that we've just looked at. The clue is in what I mentioned earlier in the sermon about the thoughts that were somewhat engendered by three successive Sabbaths with a death. God has a plan. God has a plan. Did any of these accounts, these stories, these lives happen by accident? Did any of them sneak past God and get past his attention? Were they under God's radar? Was there ever a time in any of those four lives where God was not in ultimate control and charge? Was there a single moment that passed without his knowledge or permission or allowance for the events to happen? The answer to all those questions is no. No. None of these things happened by accident. There was not a time in any of those stories where God was not in charge. There was not a single moment that went by without his knowledge and his permission and his allowance for these things to happen. They all happened for a reason. Each of them for a very specific reason that God had in mind. I guess you could say there is one other common thread to the four stories as well. And that is that none of these people knew what those specific reasons for the events in their lives would have been at first. That's why we took a look at it and tried to put ourselves in their shoes and ask what was running through their minds. So let's step back a minute and think about what I asked you to keep in mind. Do you remember what it was? Do you remember the phrase? Frame of reference. Let's think about something to give us a comparison. You and I, at this moment, are whirling around the sun at approximately 66,000 miles per hour. I hope that doesn't make you nauseous if you have motion sickness. Are you feeling dizzy? Any better? I hope not. Probably not. That's because the earth is doing exactly the same thing. From our frame of reference, the world we live on appears to be stationary. Except it's also spinning on its axis at several hundred miles an hour, but I didn't even want to throw that in to make you really sick. The thing is, from our point of reference, the world we live on is stationary. It's the universe that's doing all the moving. How do we express it when we see the sun first thing in the morning? What do we say? The earth rotated so that the sun appeared after being hidden all night long. Is that the way we say it? No, we say the sun came up. What happens as the seasons change? Do we say, well, at 66,000 miles an hour, we've made one quarter of the trip around the sun, so the season has advanced by one. We're now in spring. You can't know it from looking outside, but we're at spring. No, we say, well, the days are getting longer. The sun's getting warmer and stronger, we hope. And we talk about it from our point of view, from our frame of reference. Frame of reference makes all the difference, if you'll pardon the pun, in the world. It's not a phrase we use very often, but it's an idea, it's a concept we have to use every day. You know, it really comes into play when we make observations like, you're on the road, you're on the highway, you're on the turnpike out here, and you say, I'm going 5 miles an hour faster than that car next to me, as you pull out and slowly pass somebody. Or, oh, you look at your speedometer and say, I'm going 15 miles an hour over the speed limit right now. Or you look in your rearview mirror and say, wow, that state trooper sure is gaining on me. Wonder why all those pretty lights are flashing. Speed requires a frame of reference. You can't just be going 75 miles per hour. You have to be going 75 miles per hour in relation to something else. Here on the planet Earth, where we all are supposed to live, our frame of reference is the surface of the planet. That's why when the police officer asks us, when that nice individual makes us come to a stop and we're no longer going 75 miles an hour or 85 miles an hour, or whatever we were doing. And he asks you, do you know how fast you're going? The right answer isn't faster than the other guy, or slower than you were, or 66,000 with respect to the sun, so what's another 15 at this point in time? That probably will not get you out of getting a ticket. He's asking, how fast do you think you were going in relation to the surface of the earth? He doesn't care about the 66,000 miles per hour thing going around the sun. He doesn't say that last part because it's implied. Even if we don't understand it, we live with it. We live by it every day. That's a good thing because, you know, if you got on the turnpike and it said speed limit 70 in relation to the surface of the earth, it would look kind of silly. Here's a question for you. Does our frame of reference make the speed at which the earth is traveling around the sun irrelevant? Well, if you'd lived in the days of Joshua and the long day, Joshua's long day, when the earth stopped spinning on its axis for approximately 12 hours, or maybe a little longer, there was a whole series of miracles back then, including preserving everybody and everything on the surface of the earth from smashing into the planet. Obviously, it isn't irrelevant. It makes a difference. All you have to do is try to imagine what would happen if the earth stopped traveling at 66,000 miles an hour around the sun. And if we didn't, if you kept traveling 66,000 miles an hour and the earth stopped, I think you would notice the difference. It would be like, you know, the ejection seat in a jet. You'd probably very quickly get a sense of why that number matters a very great deal. Our problem is that we're not really put together in our minds to keep track of multiple frames of reference. You know, unless you're a physics teacher or a rocket scientist, I don't think you'd have much reason to even think about the things I've just talked about on a regular basis. Day in, day out, our frame of reference tells us, and we believe it, that we live on a stationary planet. That Earth remains perfectly still while the universe rolls around past us in the heavens all day. That's not what's happening. The truth of the matter is that we live on a massive, gigantic, organic spaceship that is whirling its way around a star, which is not particularly distinguished as bigger or, you know, it's just kind of an average run-of-the-mill star. And that's within a galaxy that is traveling at unfathomable speeds through an ever-expanding universe. That's what's really happening. But do we really think about that all that much? That's a little harder to wrap our minds around. But it's still true. It's still true. Let's get back to our four friends from Scripture before you all get dizzy traveling at 66,000 miles per hour around the sun. I hope the snacks that we have later are the kind that settle your stomach nicely and, you know, never mind. You know, Joseph was in that pit for a reason. He was there for a purpose. Same thing is true for Job sitting on the ash heap, scraping himself with a potsherd at his boils. Esther was in the king's harem for a reason. The blind man was sitting there begging by the side of the road for a reason. They were all there for a purpose. But from their frame of reference, they couldn't see it, could they? From what we've read so far, the accounts that we've followed to that point, we don't see that they could understand. For each one of them, I would think their situation must have looked pretty hopeless, don't you think? From our example of the earth and the universe and that speeding ticket that you may be getting, we know that all four of our biblical friends were looking at that stationary world. Even though everything looked like it was standing still to them, God was moving each one of them towards something. And maybe he was moving them at 66,000 miles per hour. Who knows? But for them, they still had to be asking the question, why me? Why is God allowing this? Doesn't he care? Has he forgotten me? Why am I here? Wouldn't you or I be asking those questions if something like that happened to us? I suspect we would. But you know, the thing is, and all of us know it because we have the inspired Word of God, we have the book. You know, there's a wonderful thing about a book. You can skip ahead and see what happens at the last chapter. And we know that those four stories don't stop there, do they? They don't stop there. You take Joseph, for example. How long was it until the picture became clear to Joseph? We think he was about 17 when he was taken by his brothers and sold to the Midianite slave traders. Well, based on that, we know exactly how old he was when he finally came out of prison. And we know about the 7 good years before the famines came. And then we know there's a point of reference, there's a frame of reference that we have when he states something that tells us he saw what God was doing. And that was 2 years into the famine. You add all that up, and we suspect it was 22 years before Joseph knew what the reason was. That's a long time to continue to labor and go forward and keep God first and be obedient and continue to set a right example, waiting for understanding. There's a psalm that says, "A good understanding have all those who do his commandments." What it doesn't say is when the understanding always comes. It implies that you have to obey first, and then you understand the reasons for it. If Joseph was sold, as we believe, at age 17, then his life went something like this. He was put in prison after he had served Potiphar. Had he done anything wrong as the servant to Potiphar? No, he had not. He was falsely accused. In the prison, he was there until the age of 30. We don't know how long he served Potiphar, how long it was before he was slapped in jail. We're not told that. We know that he stood before Pharaoh, the Bible tells us, at the age of 30. Then the 7 good years went by. 2 years of the famine passed. When did he understand? Turn to Genesis 45. One of the most touching stories in the Bible, in my book. Well, in your book too, the one on your lap. In verse 1 of Genesis 45, then Joseph could not restrain himself before all those who stood by him, and he cried out, "Make everyone go out from me." So no one stood with him while Joseph made himself known to his brothers. And he wept aloud, and the Egyptians and the house of Pharaoh heard it. And he said to his brothers, "I am Joseph. Does my father still live?" But his brothers couldn't answer him, for they were dismayed in his presence. Joseph said to his brothers, "Please come near to me." And they came near, and he said, "I am Joseph, your brother, whom you sold into Egypt." Now look at the words that follow. "But now do not therefore be grieved or angry with yourselves because you sold me here. For God sent me before you to preserve life. For these 2 years the famine has been in the land, and there are still 5 years in which there will be neither plowing nor harvesting. And God sent me before you to preserve a posterity for you in the earth, and to save your lives by a great deliverance. So now it was not you who sent me here, but God. And he has made me a father to Pharaoh, lord of all his house, and a ruler throughout all the land of Egypt." You can almost see Joseph realizing when he saw his brothers standing before him, "I know why this is now." And he told them, he shared it with them. God intended to establish the nation of Israel in Egypt, we find in the next chapter, in verse 3, because he appeared to Israel, or Jacob, in a dream and told him not to fear to go to Egypt. "Don't fear to go down to Egypt, for I will make of you a great nation there." That was God's purpose. That was God's plan. What would that lead up to eventually? It would lead eventually to that nation becoming enslaved. And those people wouldn't have been able to see what it was all about either. But then eventually, they would be set free. And it would be a pattern for God's people throughout the ages to learn the lesson of coming out of Egypt. We talk about it every year, the spring holidays, don't we? Perspective, frame of reference. Joseph got a glimpse of it here. 22 years after being sold as a slave, God set out to accomplish a very important part of his plan through Joseph. And it all started in a pit with no water. The same pit where Joseph had to have wondered if God had abandoned him. Had God abandoned him? Not at all. Who gave him favor with Potiphar? Who gave him favor with the prison keeper? Who revealed the meaning of dreams to him? Who gave him favor in Pharaoh's court? Had God abandoned him? Not for a minute. Not for a minute. God was with him every step of the way. But Joseph couldn't see it for 22 years. That's a long time. Only when the final pieces were in place, when it was time to move Israel to Egypt, then the lights went on. then he could see it. God sent me here to preserve, he said, a posterity for you. In other words, a line of succession. Children to come after you. For God to preserve the lineage of our father Jacob. He sent me here to do that. And this is how he chose to have it done. He used you in his plan. He used your hateful instincts toward me to bring it about. What about Job? We know that Joseph's story did not happen by accident. We can see. What about Job? When did Job's life story finally make sense to Job? Well, for him, the pieces didn't make sense until God answered out of the whirlwind. He'd lost his health, his children, nearly all of his earthly possessions. He was surrounded by miserable comforters, as he called them in Job 16 and verse 2, who were more interested in preaching at him than in trying to comfort him or console him. We even have the phrase now in English, an idiom, say, don't be a Job's comforter, and that's where it comes from. He sat on a pile of ashes, using a potsherd, a broken piece of pottery, to scrape at the sores that were covering his body. We read it in Job 2 and verse 8. In his mind, there was no doubt, apparently, as we read through the book of Job, there was no doubt that God was actually unjustly persecuting him. You read through, his frame of mind did begin to deteriorate. At first, he didn't accuse God of wrongdoing, but then he began to demand to see God so he could demand an answer of him. He was prepared to face God in court, if I can put it that way, and prove it. And then God spoke. And in Job 38 and verse 2, it says that he thundered out of the whirlwind and he said, "Who is this who darkens counsel by words without knowledge?" And the next four chapters are filled with pointed questions from God and not a single answer from Job. Question after question after question after question. Where were you, Job, when I did this? Where were you when this happened? Where were you? What do you know about this? What can you tell me about that? Tell me, if you're so, you know, wise and all-knowing, explain it to me. Question after question after question. God reminded Job how little he really knew and how very little room he had to hurl accusations against the God of the universe. Even then, it's not until we see Job's answer that we realize that for him, the pieces all came together. In Job 42, Job 42 and verse 1, "Then Job answered the Eternal and said, 'I know that you can do everything and that no purpose of yours can be withheld from you. You ask, who is this who hides counsel without knowledge? Therefore, I have uttered what I did not understand. Things too wonderful for me, which I did not know. Listen, please, and let me speak. You said, I will question you, and you shall answer me. I have heard of you by the hearing of the ear. But now my eye sees you. Therefore, I abhor myself, and I repent in dust and ashes.'" Those are famous words to all of us. I'm sure we've read them many, many times. When Job realized. Now, let me ask you this. Was there ever a time when God was not in full control of what was happening in Job's life? Was there ever a time when God somehow missed a step and didn't catch what Satan was doing? From the beginning of the book, from the moment God asks Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job?" Job chapter 1 and verse 8, how he's a perfect and an upright man, one who fears God and eschews evil. And of course, Satan poo-pooed the idea. From that moment, God had a plan, and he was putting it in motion. Satan didn't get it. As brilliant as he is as a spirit being, he didn't see it. God was in control. Satan saw this as some great contest. He said, well, yeah, but if you take away everything he has, he'll curse you to your face. God said, all right, take away everything he has. Well, if you struck his body, if you made him terribly sick or ill, then he'll curse you. Satan just saw it as this big contest. Well, I'm going to turn up the heat. I'm going to make Job curse God. That's not what happened. Job had some inadequacies revealed to him, but not quite the way Satan thought. You know, James wrote later in the book of James, in chapter 5 and verse 11, he wrote, "You have heard of the perseverance of Job and seen the end intended by the Lord." He goes on to say that the Lord is very compassionate and merciful. But that's an interesting phrase. You have heard of the perseverance of Job, and you have seen the end intended by the Lord. God had a plan in motion in Job's life, and he was working it out. God allowed Satan to torment Job, not because he, that is God, had anything he had to prove to Satan. There was no contest. That was all in Satan's mind, his warped view. He used Satan's appetite and desire for destruction to help refine Job's character, which God knew was needed, so that he could come to the point in chapter 42 of saying, "I have heard of you by the hearing of the ear. I thought I knew all about you. But now my eye sees you. And I repent. I abhor myself and I repent in dust and ashes." Job's story was not by accident either. God allowed these things for a reason. Job came to a relationship depth with God that he had never had before. Never. What about Esther? When did she know? Well, let's go back and take a look. A few pages back to Esther. We find in chapter 3 that the court politics are heating up. And there's a man by the name of Haman, who's described as wicked Haman in very many places. And he couldn't stand even the sight of Esther's cousin, Mordecai. He had this grandiose idea that what he really wanted to do was build a gallows higher than any that had ever been seen and hang Mordecai on it. Well, the plot thickens here, and finally it comes out in Esther chapter 3 and verse 13 what got done at Haman's urging. "And the letters were sent by couriers into all the king's provinces to destroy, to kill, to annihilate all the Jews, both young and old, little children and women, in one day. On the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, and to plunder their possessions." That was the goal. That's what Haman wanted to be able to do. Well, Mordecai got wind of this, and he knew what was happening. And so there was some communication between Esther and Mordecai. And so we find in chapter 4, Mordecai tells this representative from Esther all that had happened to him and the sum of money that Haman had promised to pay into the king's treasuries to destroy the Jews. And he gave him a copy of the written decree for their destruction, which was given at Shushan or Susa, that he might show it to Esther and explain it to her, that he might command her to go into the king to make supplication to him and plead before him for her people. So this agent, Hathach, returned, and he told Esther the words of Mordecai. Then Esther spoke to Hathach and gave him a command for Mordecai. All the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces know that any man or woman who goes into the inner court to the king who has not been called, he has but one law. Put all to death, except the one to whom the king holds out the golden scepter that he may live. Yet I myself have not been called to go into the king these 30 days. She says, I don't know whether I'm out of favor. Things are terrible in here, frankly. It's awful. It's just rivals and bickering, and it's just terrible. And I don't know where I stand with him. I haven't seen him for 30 days. So they told Mordecai Esther's words. And what was his response? Then Mordecai told them to answer Esther, "Do not think in your heart that you will escape in the king's palace any more than all the other Jews." She hadn't yet revealed her ethnicity. "For if you remain completely silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place. But you and your father's house will perish. Yet who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this?" Powerful words. Who knows whether you have come to the kingdom? He said, Esther, this is why you are here. You've wondered, why am I here? Why did all this happen? Now you know. This is why you're here. This is what God has been working toward. And He is using you as His instrument to bring it about. So she responded in verse 16, "Gather all the Jews who are present in Susa or Shushan and fast for me. Neither eat nor drink for 3 days, night and day. My maids and I will fast likewise, and so I will go to the king, which is against the law, and if I perish, I perish." A very brave woman. She saw. Now, apparently, this really worked, because in chapter 8, verse 15, it says, "Now Mordecai went out from the presence of the king in royal apparel of blue and white, with a great crown of gold and a garment of linen and purple, and the city of Susa or Shushan rejoiced and was glad. The Jews had light and gladness, joy and honor. And in every province and city, wherever the king's command and decree came, the Jews had joy and gladness, a feast and a holiday. And then many of the people of the land became Jews, because fear of the Jews fell upon them." Suddenly it became very advantageous in Persia to be a Jew. "Oh, I'm a Jew. It's like four generations back, and it was my great-grandfather's distant cousin who immigrated from, you know. But I have Jewish lineage. Check it out. Here's my birth certificate. I just wrote it up last night myself in my basement." So it became very popular, very good thing to be a Jew in Persia in those days. Apparently it really worked. Esther's story did not happen by accident. We still have one left, don't we? Actually, we have two. What about the blind man? Well, it took a miracle before his life made any sense. He was blind in a culture where any misfortune like that was to everybody else, to everybody around, was a clear proof of sin. So much so that even the disciples, who had listened to Christ and been with him for, at this point, between 2.5 and 3 years in his ministry, asked and they said, "Rabbi, who sinned?" You know, they took one look at this man begging on the street and they said, "Huh, who sinned? Was it him? Was it his parents? Grandparents, great-grandparents, second cousin 4 times removed. Who was it?" They assumed and equated it with sin. You know, who's at fault here? Where do we put the blame? That was their question. Christ's response must have shocked everybody who heard him in that culture and in that time. Verse 3, Jesus answered, John 9:3, "Neither this man nor his parents sinned, but that the works of God should be revealed in him. You know, it's going to be very interesting to find out in the kingdom when the millennial reign begins, when Christ returns. It will be very interesting to find out if this formerly blind man was one of the original 120 disciples. That will be fascinating to find out. Wouldn't that be amazing? This must have shattered an entire cultural construct. Just shattered it in a minute. Nobody sinned. What? How can that be? He's blind. Somebody had to sin. Jesus said, nope. Nobody sinned. This happened so that God's power could be shown. He was born blind, not from sin, but for a purpose. For this moment. This moment. A lifetime of blindness that came together in one unbelievable miracle that would open the eyes not only of this man, but maybe many who stood by watching. We're not told all the details. It was such a transformation that you find in verses 8 and 9, there were people saying they weren't even sure if it was the same man. Some said, this is the one who was begging, he was blind. They said, no, he looks kind of like him, but it's not the same one. And the other, no, this is the same guy. It transformed him completely. This wasn't so much restoring his sight. Jesus created his sight. It says he was born blind. He had never seen anything. The pathways in the brain did not exist. It was a series of miracles. And it was astonishing. Astonishing. Well, quite a statement. Later on, when this blind man was called before the council to explain himself, the Pharisees, of course, didn't want to admit that Jesus had done this. And so they questioned the parents. They said, is your son? Was he born blind? The parents said, well, he's of age. Ask him. He can speak for himself. They were afraid. And with reason. Because this blind man had a bit of humor in him too. I kind of like this guy. In verse 24, they called the man who was blind and they said, give God the glory. We know that this man is a sinner. You know, somebody's got to be sinning here. Let's face it. And he answered and said, whether he's a sinner or not, I don't know. One thing I know, I was born blind. Now I can see, you know. He said, don't you guys get it? Blind, see. Blind, see. They didn't like that very much. Well, then they said, well, what did he do to you? How did he open your eyes? Maybe it was just a very complicated medical procedure that we've never heard of before. He said, I told you already. And you didn't believe me. He said, do you want to become his disciples too? Oh, that went over real big. They ended up excommunicating him. He was willing to risk. He told them, he said in verses 32, we know that God doesn't hear sinners, but if anyone's a worshiper of God and does his will, he hears him. Since the world began, it's not been heard of. It has been unheard of. That anyone opened the eyes of one who was born blind. If this man were not from God, he couldn't do anything. Oh, they didn't like that at all. And they threw him out of the temple. They excommunicated him. His physical vision led him to a spiritual conclusion that he was willing to accept, even when the Pharisees couldn't. Even when it meant banishment from the synagogue, which was the core of existence of first century Jewish life. That's why I say I wonder if he was one of the original 120 disciples. When Jesus revealed himself to this man as the Son of God, do you think he held any bitterness about the years he spent without sight? I don't think so, given by the words we see here in John chapter 9. Instead, he fell to the ground to worship his Creator. It was clear now that every single one of those years had been spent leading up to one unbelievable moment seeing and believing in the Son of God Himself. The blind man's story did not happen by accident either. Guess who we're going to look at next? What's the story of your life? What kind of trials, kinds of trials, maybe there are multiple kinds, are you going through? Do all the pieces make sense to you yet? One thing, brethren, we must believe. They will make sense. For Dick Hendenlang, it was cancer, beginning in the back of his throat, spreading to his lungs, bones, and the hospice nurse I spoke to Monday said they suspected his brain as well at the end. It was cancer. What was his focus? I think about half the congregation went down to visit him at one time or another. It was getting to attend one more feast. I want to go to one more feast. He told me when he booked his flights, I'm going to go to one more feast. Spending as much time as possible with God's people. His daughter's message was very telling when she said, Dad loved your congregation. And I kept telling him when he could not seem to understand why so many people wanted to come and see him and sending cards. And I'd say, well, you have endeared yourself to this congregation. He didn't want to hear that. But he didn't want to miss being here either. Making sure his life was pleasing in God's sight. Jettisoning anything in his life that didn't contribute to his overall purpose in some way. Or didn't support it, at least. Setting a fine example in his final months as a fitting culmination to his decades of service to God. I'm reminded of something that a good friend of mine, David Trabig, said when his father Harold died several years ago after serving in the ministry many years. Dave Trabig said about his dad, he showed us how to live and he showed us how to die. So did Dick Hendenlang. When do all the pieces of our lives make sense? I can't answer that for each individual case. So please don't come up afterwards. I will just direct you to Mr. Patchinger. And he will multiply it by 7. And then you'll know. I can't answer that, and neither can he. But I know somebody who can. Sometimes it doesn't make sense until the end of the story, but there is always a reason. We've seen that God had his reasons in the lives of Joseph and Job and Esther and the blind man in the book of John. He has his reasons in our lives too, brethren. You know, today we look back on the lives of those four people in the Bible and we say, well, I see, I get it. Of course, I see it now as God explains it in his word. One day, we will look back on the difficult parts of our lives like that too. And we'll say, I see, I get it. I see it now. Maybe we can't always do that just yet, at least not for all the difficult parts. Maybe we can do it for some parts. And that's okay, because God can. We just don't have the right frame of reference yet. We see an earth that is standing still. So we think. God sees an earth that is flying around the sun at 66,000 miles per hour, which is hurtling around a galaxy that is rushing through an ever-expanding universe. It's a little different frame of reference. Maybe it gives meaning to Isaiah 55, verses 8 and 9. My thoughts are not your thoughts. God knows where he wants to take you and me, and he knows why. Do you and I trust him? Romans chapter 9, Romans 9 and verse 20, cutting into the middle of a description and a discussion here. But indeed, O man, who are you to reply against God? Will the thing formed say to him who formed it, why have you made me like this? Doesn't the potter have power over the clay from the same lump to make one vessel for honor and another for dishonor? What if God, wanting to show his wrath and to make his power known, endured with much long suffering the vessels of wrath prepared for destruction, and that he might make known the riches of his glory on the vessels of mercy, which he had prepared beforehand for glory? Even us whom he called, not of the Jews only, but also of the Gentiles. Good questions, all. Many times, we may not always be sure what kind of vessel God's making us into. We probably prefer to think about the fancy, you know, Grecian urn. But there are other kinds of vessels we don't want to think about much sometimes. Also that are made from clay from the same lump. We're not really in a position to criticize God's handiwork, are we? How can we cast doubt on what he's planning or allowing in our lives? Now, I'm not including things where we do it to ourselves by foolish, wrong decisions and sinful actions. But from where we are right now, sometimes we can't see any more clearly than Joseph or Job or Esther or the blind man. Ironic, isn't it, that the blind man finally came to see? But they did, eventually, and so can we. Here's the assurance in James chapter 1. Here's a better approach. James 1 and verse 2, my brethren, count it all joy when you fall into various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces patience, or endurance, the margin says. But let patience have its perfect work, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking nothing. Here's the assurance. There is a reason. Even if you and I cannot see it clearly from where we're standing in our lives right now, God has a reason for everything he allows. The path to being second in command in Egypt began in a pit with no water. The path to a much deeper relationship with God began on a heap of ashes. The path to Queen, who delivered her people, began in a harem. The path to the revelation of God's incredible power and perfect will began with blindness. When these stories began, the end was clear to nobody but God. When they ended, the value of every moment along the way became obvious to the four principles in our little cast of characters here. You know, we may not understand our path until we're quite far along it. And that's okay. We don't have to. Not right now. God does. And in the meantime, we can all rest assured of one simple truth. Our stories are not happening by accident.